Welcome to the Second Court of Appeals. We have two cases on our afternoon docket. Our 130 case is Passy West versus Warner Allen Properties. If the clerk will please announce counsel.
May it please the court, Mr. Frank Gilchrist argues for appellant and Mr. Thomas Howard argues for appellate.
Mr. Gilchrist.
May it please the court. I represent the Wynn family that owns Passy West, Inc., that owned an apartment complex in Fort Worth called Westcliff Manor. In July of 2005, we contracted to sell this property to Warner Allen, our opponents, for $5.78 million. After the contract was signed, and this contract called for them to assume our loan, after the contract was signed, there was some discussion about an exchange of letters involving whether they could, in fact, bring a new loan. And we drew up an amended contract and sent it to them that allowed them to bring a new loan as opposed to assuming our loan. But before that amended contract was signed, we got what we call the beatdown letter. And that was a letter, I believe, on September 5th, in which Warner Allen said, you know, this apartment complex really isn't worth as much as we're paying, it needs all this maintenance work, and besides, our lender may not do the deal. And there is evidence, as stated in the court's first opinion in this case, that some of the statements in there were not only false, they were intentionally false. And our clients got their back up and they said, no, we're not going to sign the amended contract, we'll close on the first contract. Well, it didn't close, we have a lawsuit. 3 years later, this court decides the case, and it decides that we didn't have to sign the amended contract. The exchange of letters that preceded the amended contract created a contract that allowed them to bring their own loan and not assume our loan. Okay, we lost. We went back and we closed the contract in August of 2009, and the proceeds were $2.1 million. However, we don't have those proceeds in hand. They're being held in escrow pending the outcome of the case on remand, because the court remanded the case saying that Warner Allen was also entitled to recover the expenses incurred as a result of our late performance. We had a trial on that. We lost. The court awarded, the jury awarded several items of damages, including $443,000, representing the loss of lost profits for 47 months. The total is about $1.5 million now. And so if we lose, the Wynns are going to only wind up with $600,000. We are complaining about the court's failure to admit evidence during that trial. And there's two kinds of evidence we wanted to come in. First was evidence as to the reasons for the delay. We say we had to go back, we had a right to go back and have the jury hear the circumstances surrounding the formation of the contract, and particularly the beatdown letter. We think a jury would have concluded that Warner Allen, because they sent the beatdown letter, caused the contract not to close. And moreover, we think that the jury could have at least concluded that we did not, that we are not responsible for the delay up until the time the court finally told us what the law was, because nobody really knew what the law was until then. Now, the judge wouldn't let this in. And we say that he should have, and that's our first issue here. They say, well, no, you can't bring that evidence in. It is related to the unclean hands question, which the court denied, and that's right. In its first opinion, the court said, this is not sufficient evidence of unclean hands to defeat their equitable claim for specific performance. But that's not what's at issue here. The issue is who is responsible for the delay. And we think that a jury should hear who is responsible. It's kind of like contributory negligence. I mean, I'm the driver at the, plaintiff and I'm the defendant. I hit somebody and the court only lets the jury hear about my negligence, my conduct. They don't let the court hear about the other side's conduct. Let me just take you through an analogy here that I think, an argument out here that explains what our reasons for this. If the issue is whether my conduct caused the delay, That's what the court remanded it for. Whether how much the delay caused by my conduct, I can certainly show that I did not cause the delay, or at least part of the delay. I certainly can do that. And to do that, I can show that someone else caused the delay. That's what we say should have gone in front of the judge and the jury, and the jury wanted to hear about it. Look at page third volume of the clerk's record, page 457. Here are some questions that the jury sent out during deliberation. Question: are we permitted to ask what prevented the sale to occur in 2005? They wanted to know. Court: sorry, you're not permitted to ask. Question: if not, then how do we base our decision on the alleged lost profits over the 47 months in question? Answer: your decision must be based on the evidence and nothing else, and they didn't hear the evidence. That's what we say is one kind of evidence that should have gone in. There's another kind, which we call the offset, but first I want to touch on what I think their principal argument here is, and that we did not preserve error, the preservation error, the issue. The judge handed down a pretrial order that said that we are precluded from offering any evidence or argument that's not relevant to the amount of damages that were caused by our delay, including why we breached the contract, the very evidence that we wanted to come in. The law, and they say, well, gosh, you should have offered that evidence. You should have asked for a jury question. No, we didn't have to. Under the Huckabee case, if there's a pretrial order that says the evidence can't come in, you don't have to go through the meaningless exercise of offering it. Well, their response is, well, no, it's really an order in limine. And if they're right on that, then we didn't preserve because we didn't offer the evidence. And on an order in limine, you have to say, judge, you have to approach the judge, I want this in. Even though you've signed an order in limine, I want to introduce it. He has to make a ruling. That's the error. Well, is it an order in limine? Well, they point to an exchange. On page 4, volume 4 of the reporter's record, in which Mr. Chastain says, as you recall, Your Honor, we had a hearing in chambers on some limine items. What I've handed you is the order in limine. They say that's the order, and the parties were treating it as an order in limine. No, they weren't. Here's the order on pretrial rulings that we're talking about on page 419 of the clerk's record. Here's the order on agreed items in motion in limine, the very next item, 421. That's the order he was talking about. And if you want to look at page the original motion in limine, it's on page 24 of the first supplemental clerk's record. That's the order that they were referring to, and this is a classic order in limine. It precludes such things as any reference to plaintiff's failure to call a witness to testify if the witness was equally available to both sides. The usual pages of boilerplate stuff that's always in an order in limine. Nothing in here about the evidence we wanted to put in. Moreover, look at the order on pretrial rulings. It doesn't talk about the motion in limine. It says this is in response to plaintiff's motion for partial summary judgment concerning remaining issues, and our motion for summary judgment to define scope of trial. That information is in the first supplemental clerk's record, volume 1, pages 86 to 258, and in the fourth supplemental clerk's record, pages 2 through 8. That's what the court was ruling on. It's not a motion in limine. Now, so we did preserve error. Now, let me go back and talk about the second issue, the second kind of evidence that we wanted to come in. And that is the evidence of what we call offset. You see, the basis for the court's ruling is a line of cases that says, well, where you grant specific performance and where there's a delay in closing, we're going to put the parties back where they were, would have been if they had closed on the day of closing, the day they should have closed, which was back in 05 instead of 09 when we finally closed, 47 months. And one of the things that you can get is either rent or lost profits. And the jury awarded that. But the cases also say you can get an offset for money that they didn't have to expend. Well, one of the things we wanted was an offset for $500,000 in improvements to the property. The court said there's no evidence that, and we brought in an appraisal showing the property had increased. The court said there was no evidence of causation. I'm going to leave it at that. But the second thing we wanted to put in was evidence concerning interest. You see, not only did they get 4 years of lost profits, they got a four-year free ride on the interest. They did not have to pay $5.78 million in 05. They didn't have to pay it till 09. And the cases say you're entitled to get the interest. There are several cases that say that. Well, here we don't have a preservation issue because the judge went ahead and heard this in a subsequent hearing. He actually heard these offset issues, non-jury, and he made findings and he ruled. I say that's in the nature of a separate trial under Rule 40B, and he separately tried the offset issues.
Could you please clarify your interest contention? Are you saying that you wanted to introduce evidence on the interest that your client had to continue paying?
No, on the interest rate, rate that money would have drawn. And the point is this, and the judge, let me just say what the judge did. The judge said, well, this was an all-cash deal, and this is in his findings. This is an all-cash deal. You don't get interest when it's an all-cash deal. He says it's not an all-cash deal. If it had been an all-cash deal and they had brought $5.7 million of their own money, they would not have to pay interest on that for four, they would lose the interest on that for 4 years, therefore, and they would get the interest. But since they had a loan, they didn't come with $5.78 million in their own pocket. They don't get interest. And that's transparently false. And there's no case that says that. And there's no basis for distinguishing between an all-cash deal and where you bring a loan. If they had brought all cash that they had in the bank and been drawing interest, it would have been gone, and they wouldn't get that interest anymore. Okay? They would lose that interest, okay? And if they had borrowed it, they would have been paying interest during the same 4 years. So either way, we're entitled to an offset for the interest.
Brenda, I have a question.
Yes.
And this may be something that's just forgotten that I read. Why did it matter whether they assumed the loan or got a new loan?
At the beginning?
Yeah. Were they somehow involved in lending the money?
No. I think that there were some differences in the amount of money that would have had to been paid to the existing lender, and maybe some repairs that would have had to be done to satisfy the existing lenders. There was a difference, some monetary difference between the two. And it probably doesn't seem like it enough now, but it was a lot to the people at the time. And I can't really tell you exactly what it was, Judge Dolfino. But there was it would have made some difference in the money.
Was there a penalty for early payment?
I don't know. Okay. I'm sorry. Let me tell you, but their second argument on this, besides the argument which the court made, is that, well, it didn't make any difference because the jury also found that we made $870,000 in profit. That's about the amount of interest. And so the court could have simply not awarded that in response to this jury finding. They got a case, the Byram case, that allowed the court to do something like that. The people said we didn't get interest, and Judge Pemberton in the Austin Court of Appeals said, well, that's true, but there was evidence of other damages. But the problem was in Byron, there were no findings and conclusions. And of course, the court can do whatever it wants to make the numbers work when there are no findings and conclusions. Here, we had findings and conclusions, and insofar as the money, the $870,000 in our profit, the court said, and it's finding in conclusion six, I'm not going to punish us, the Wins, for being a more frugal manager of the property than Warner Allen would have been. And in any event, even if you could somehow say, well, the court was really allowing for this $870,000 in profits to the Winds, you got to remember, they had $500,000 in lost profits. They don't get both. They don't get the profits they lost and the profits that we made. There would be some overlap there. The best there would be $300,000. There's just not enough to get there. It's contrary to the findings and conclusions, and the judge had the discretion to say, I'm not going to award them the $870,000. Is my time up?
Yes.
All right. I'm sorry.
That's fine.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Gilstrap. Mr. Allen.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court. Thomas Allen on behalf of Appellees and Cross Appellants Warner Allen. In the time I'd have, I'd like to address the issues that were raised by opposing counsel and then switch gears and turn briefly to our cross appeal regarding attorney's fees. I think when we think about this case, it's important to remember how we got here. This is the second appeal arising out of this lawsuit. In its first opinion, this court held that Paso West was not entitled to breach the party's contract, that Warner Allen had no unclean hands, and that Warner Allen was entitled to equitable relief. In doing so, this court stated expressly that Paso West was responsible for its own default, and any harm suffered by Paso West was its own doing. And then it remanded, only for a trial on damages. This context is crucial. In these various pretrial motions, and as we heard today from opposing counsel, Paso West made it very clear that it intended to retry many of the same issues that had already been raised and disposed of by this court in the first appeal. We heard it today, and on page 13 of their opening brief, they say that the jury should have been entitled to hear, quote, the circumstances surrounding the original controversy in the first instance. And they tried to make that argument to the trial court. The trial court refused, and it did enter this February 2010 pretrial order. But contrary to their contention, that is absolutely not an abuse of discretion, let alone harmful error. It is entirely consistent with this court's remand because the questions about Paso West's reasons for breaching the contract, whether we had unclean hands, were irrelevant to the issues before the jury. The only issue for the jury was finding damages. It was in its remand, this court never suggested that the jury could also engage in some sort of equitable balancing. And Paso West's argument really founders on a basic misapprehension of the respective roles of the court and the jury. It's axiomatic that the jury finds facts, in this case, the amount of damages. It does not dispense equity. These other contentions, these other issues that were precluded by this pretrial order were proper, if at all, only before the trial court. And the trial court gave Paso West the chance to do so. 3 months after the jury trial, it allowed Paso West to put on anything that it wanted under the guise of equity. And for that reason alone, there's certainly no harmful error in this ruling. Opposing counsel mentioned this jury confusion point. I'll only say that the fact that that a juror was curious about the rest of the story, about what happened and why the contract was breached, does not mean that they were confused about awarding the specific amount of damages. There was no objection to the damages question by Paso West. And the trial court at voir dire and the party's lawyers all made clear to the jury, they said, we know this will be frustrating to you, you'll want to know what happened, but you're only here to decide damages. With regard to the motion in limine point, this is not our principal contention, it only goes to their preservation. As we explained in our brief, we think it was quite clear that this was based on contested issues in Warner Allen's original motion in limine. That's what Mr. Chastain's testimony says. If the court would look, when it looks at the trial court's January 28th order, which is the first supplemental clerk's record 259, the court says, instead of dealing with these contested issues in the motion in limine, I'm going to ask the parties to brief the remaining issues to be tried. It was clearly understood by everyone that these were limine issues. But even if preserved, this argument founders because there was no abuse of discretion by the trial court. Now, in its brief, Paso West also attributes further error to the trial court's order. It claims, though opposing counsel hasn't really said so today, that the order precluded them from offering evidence of these offsets, equitable or otherwise. Context is, again, important to recall here. For all its prominence now, this theory of offset was remarkably absent from the record below. Paso West never pled, argued, or presented competent evidence of any offset until 3 months later at the May 2010 hearing. Until that point, their theory had been Warner Allen suffered no damages whatsoever. Mr. Wynn testified that by breaching the contract, he had done Warner Allen a favor because Warner Allen, if it had assumed ownership of the property in 2005, would have suffered damages of $1.6 million. It was only after they lost with the jury on that theory that Paso West changed its tune and its lawyers to assert this brand new theory of equity. But the order itself, this exclusion of evidence point, has nothing to do with offset. It permits evidence that is relevant to the amount of damages, and offset from damages necessarily is relevant to that calculation. So the order doesn't do what they say it does. And why would it? Paso West had never argued offset before. Now, offset itself was not properly before the jury. There was no pleading. They had requested no jury question on it, but that has nothing to do with the order itself. Indeed, belying Paso West's reading of this order, they attempted during the jury trial to introduce some of the evidence at issue. Now, they didn't do it as an offset. They did this to bolster their Warner Allen gets no damages theory. But they tried to get in these appraisals of the value of the property, saying that the alleged increase in value between 2005 and 2009 was something they should get credit for. The trial court didn't let them do that. Why? Not because of the order, but because they couldn't present any evidence that this alleged increase in value was attributable to anything they did, as opposed merely to market forces. And notably, Paso West has not appealed that evidentiary finding. Now, turning to this issue of interest and an interest offset, again, the order itself does not address an interest offset. This is, once more, a newly hatched theory. There was no pleading, no jury question. Paso West made absolutely no attempt to argue that it should get any interest offset until the May 2010 hearing, 3 months after the jury. And what did they do at this hearing? They called their expert, Mr. Curtis, to testify about this interest. But Mr. Curtis admitted he could have given the exact same testimony to the jury during the February jury trial if Paso West had only asked him to do so. So Paso West's complaint on this interest offset really seems to be that the trial court should have, as a matter of equity, made this offset later. And that's what opposing counsel was really talking about. But there are a number of truly fatal problems to this argument. First of all, Paso West never requested a finding of fact from the trial court as to the rate of interest or the interest amount that they say should have been offset. It's hard to see how they can argue on appeal that the trial court should have read their mind and made a fact-finding they never requested. Moreover, there were serious evidentiary problems with this offset. Paso West never quantified how much the offset was they were supposed to be asking for. They ignore the fact they had to pay off their mortgage. So in 2005, if they had not breached the contract and the sale had gone through, they would have had to pay the mortgage and would have only had the leftover proceeds to do whatever they would do with and realize some interest. But they never gave that number to the trial court. The trial court can dispense equity, but it's constrained by the evidence before it. That evidence was simply not there. Also, it's important to keep in mind that this was not a seller-financed transaction. Paso West wasn't providing the financing, so it wasn't entitled to get interest on the sale. And more importantly, in response to what you heard a moment ago, Warner Allen did not have the use of this money for 4 years. They did not get a 4-year free ride, as you heard. It is undisputed that this money was coming from third-party financing that Warner Allen had to borrow. The Warner Allen's lost profits damages model, but our lost profits damages model accounts for this. It's Plaintiff's Exhibit 22 and the testimony from Dr. Frank Vorvart, who was our damages expert. It accounts for the interest we would have paid during that delay period.
So you're saying they got what they didn't
miss? Paso West?
Yes. You're saying that their complaint now has been taken care of.
Their complaint was absolutely taken care of by Dr. Vorvard's damages calculation. And with regard to Chief Justice Livingston was asking for clarification about which interest they're talking about it, and it's unclear to me too, but they also were talking about, well, maybe it's the interest they would have gotten had the sale gone through. They did primarily, and as I said, that is absolutely accounted for in that transaction, in the damages model. And I will note that all of those other issues aside, there was fundamentally no unfairness about what the trial court did. First of all, Paso West's contention that it was entitled to this offset is belied by this court's own finding that it breached the contract of its own accord and any damages it suffered were its own fault. As a matter of equity, it can't maintain that it was nevertheless entitled to benefit in any way from its breach. But actually, they did benefit. And you heard this alluded to a moment ago. The trial court was not merely equitable in what it did, but it was generous. It allowed Paso West to keep $870,000 that the jury found Paso West had earned during the four-year delay period. That number exceeds Warner Allen's entire damages. And we argued to the trial court, we said we should get that money as a disgorgement. We didn't ask for that and our lost profits. It was an either-or, but we wanted the bigger number, $870,000. We said we were entitled to as a matter of equity. It should be disgorged because of Paso West's conduct. The trial court disagreed. We lost on that. The trial court said, as a matter of equity, I'm going to allow Paso West to keep this money they made. And this reveals a great irony in their position. They contend that we got some sort of windfall by getting a portion of the damages that we asked for. In fact, it is Paso West here that is asking for a windfall. They want not only to keep the profits they made because the sale did not go through, but they have said in their brief they also want interest that they would have earned had the sale actually gone through. But they can't have it both ways. There's no but-for world in which both of those things exist. So the trial court did not abuse its discretion in dispensing equity in this manner. With regards to the Byram opinion from the Austin Court of Appeals, this case is directly on point, involving nearly identical facts in which the Court of Appeals affirmed, looked at the offset that the trial court made, and affirmed it. The Paso West point about the absence of findings of fact and conclusions of law in that case is a red herring. If you read the opinion, it doesn't turn on the implying certain findings that weren't there. It simply takes a functional view of the trial court's equitable award and says that was within its broad discretion in fashioning equity. And that's the same, entirely consistent, whether there are findings or not, with the liberal construction of findings of fact that a reviewing court will give. Paso West has complained a lot about this issue of nitpicking about certain verbiage being present or absent from the findings and conclusions, but there's no merit to this point. As a basic matter, this was never raised with the trial court. Paso West never requested specific findings. It never objected to Warner Allen's findings. This is simply an attempted ambush of the trial court. On the merits, Paso West complaints are really just a game of semantics that ignore this liberal construction of findings and conclusions. As appellant, they have the burden to overcome the presumption of the judgment's validity. And yet, as we explain in our brief, there is no functional difference between the findings and conclusions and the verbiage they say is absent. Finally, and this really leads me to this last little point, aside from the fact that this equitable offset argument was never pled, never raised before, and they cannot overcome the highly deferential standard of review, either for the dispensing of equitable relief or the ruling on evidentiary issues. Finally, my yellow light is on. I would like to address very briefly our cross-appeal on attorney's fees. As the court will recall, there were two categories of fees. Fees for our successful cross-appeal, the last time the parties were here, and for certain non-appellate attorney's fees. The parties stipulated to all of these fees in 2010. They stipulated to the amount, the reasonableness, and the necessity of those fees. And the cases are clear that under those circumstances, when you have a breach of contract case, awarding the fees is mandatory. The trial court does not have discretion not to award them. With regard to both sets of attorney's fees, Paso West has said, well, paragraph 3 of the earlier 2007 stipulation precludes us from obtaining either our cross-appeal fees or these other non-appellate fees. The problem with that argument is that, first of all, that by its own terms, that paragraph in the 2007 stipulation concerns something else entirely. It contemplates the award of additional fees in connection with remand. It has nothing to do and is silent about either of the categories of fees in at issue. And more importantly, the upshot of Paso West's argument is that the 2007 stipulation can be read as an implied waiver of the 2010 attorney's fee award. But that violates basic standards of interpreting stipulations. It also would render the later stipulation meaningless. Why in 2007 would the parties have stipulated to attorney's fees if they had already agreed why in 2010 would they have stipulated to certain attorney's fees if 3 years earlier they had already agreed those attorney's fees were foreclosed? That makes no sense. And yet that's exactly what they are asserting. And it is that's the same thing is true with regard to the non-appellate fees. In short, I see my time is up. Warner Allen respectfully prays that the court affirm the judgment of the trial court below as modified to award us the entire amount of our attorney's fees. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Allen. Mr. Gilstrap.
May it please the court. The reason we stipulated as to the attorney's fees was so we didn't have to prove up the amount. I mean, you do that all the time. According to their view, once you stipulate to attorney's fees, even in the face of a prior stipulation that doesn't cover them, you're obligated to pay them. That holding would obviously prevent anyone from stipulating as to the reasonableness, necessity, and amount of attorney's fees. We didn't concede that they were owed. We just conceded how much they were. Turning back to my original opening argument, in response to Justice Dauphineau's question on page 364 of the court's opinion, the proposed amendment that the Wins prepared would have required Warner Allen to pay all fees in connection with paying off the existing note early, including but not limited to prepayment yield maintenance. Apparently there was a prepayment fee. Now, counsel says, well, in your earlier opinion, you said any harm suffered by Paso West is its own fault. The issue here is not the harm suffered by Paso West. The issue here is not the harm suffered by Paso West. It's the harm suffered by Warner Allen. Not covered by that statement at all. They say, well, all the jury was supposed to find was the amount of damages. No, it was supposed to find causation. That's what the jury question said. Find the amount of damages that resulted from the delay in closing. That brings into play who caused the damages. Now, finally they say, well, you should have brought the evidence of interest in to the first trial. And you didn't do it. And we didn't. And if Judge Walker had come back and said, you know, counsel, you had your chance, I'm not going to let that issue be tried. It's already been tried. We would have been up a creek. But Judge Walker didn't do it. He let us try the issue. Under Rule 40B, the judge has the authority to bifurcate a trial. And he says, I'm going to give a separate trial as to the interest, the offsets. And he did it. They said, well, we never proved up. They go into some question about the interest rate. Our evidence showed 5%. That's what the evidence showed, and that's the prejudgment, the post-judgment interest rate, I believe. Not a remarkable figure, but when you think about it, 5% on what, $5.78 million for 4 years, pretty much wipes out their recovery, and we're entitled to it. They say, you didn't plead it. Well, you don't have to plead it. That's what the case says. It's not really an offset. It's simply part of the accounting that has to do with putting the parties in the position they would have been if the deal had closed in 05, like the court said, we later found out we should have done it. What's that? Because the case, normally an offset, you say, you owe me money for damaging Blackacre, and they say, well, wait a minute, you should have paid me for the horse. And that's something you have to plead. But in these cases, they don't treat it as an offset. That's the point. We use the term offset to distinguish it, equitable offset. But the cases say it's not, you don't have to plead it, and you don't have to because it's simply part of the damage calculation. It's what it takes to put them back in the same position they were. Finally, one more thing. Judge Walker, we offered an amendment before the second trial, and they moved to strike it. And Judge Walker said, what do you say about that, counsel? And the trial counsel said, well, Judge, you don't have to plead it. So, and he says, okay, I'm going to strike it. Then he heard it. He heard the question of offset. I think he had the discretion to do it, and even if it had to be pled, he had the right to hear the evidence, which he did. And besides, it doesn't have to be pled, and as Racehorse Hayden says, and besides, I don't own a dog. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Gilstrap. Thank you also to Mr. Webster, and thank you, Mr. Allen and Mr. Chastain. We appreciate your arguments and, of course, your briefing. Your case is now submitted. We will have a change of panel, so we'll take a 10-minute reset, and then we'll come back and hear the next case.
All rise.
Well, we'll see you, Mike. Say hello to Mike.
We will. Absolutely.